Positive, hopeful, and inspired, and out of hand. Artistic director of Atlanta-based Out of Hand Theater, Ariel Fristo, and I talk about the enormous impact and success her theater company have had at the intersection of art, social justice, and civic engagement. In our wide-reaching conversation, you'll learn why the New York Times called Out of Hand the best theater of 2020, and Harvard Business School is doing a case study on the company as we speak. Could their techniques apply to your organization? That might indeed seem out of hand, but I don't think it is. Listen and learn why. I'm grateful you've chosen to join me today. Ariel Fristo, I am so delighted that you have chosen to join me for TRG's Leading the Way podcast. As I've said to you, Leading the Way is about inspiring leaders for change. And you are part of really positive change. Thank you for making the time.
Oh, thank you so much for having me.
For my listeners, there's been plenty reported, but for my listeners, can you just tell us a little bit about how you started Out of Hand Theater, which is a distinctly different kind of theater organization than the regional theater business model that we might all be familiar with and that's been regularly reported on during these pandemic times?
Yes, absolutely. So yes, we started Out of Hand Theater in 2001. My friends and I were in our mid-20s. We have gotten out of a theater program and we looked around and wanted to start our own company. And even back then, 23 years ago, we realized that there were already plenty of really good theater companies in Atlanta. Atlanta did not need another theater company. We weren't going to be able to compete with them. So we decided from the get-go that we would never even try, that we'd just figure out something different to do. And what we decided to do was only make work about the issues that were most important to us. And to do that in partnership with experts, with all of these really great nonprofits and community groups in Atlanta that are working on those issues. And from the very beginning, to combine theater with other kinds of social interactions so that we could give people additional fun reasons to come to our shows. Also from the very beginning, that we would often not perform in traditional theater spaces, but we'd bring theater into spaces where it wasn't often happening, and thereby to audiences who weren't necessarily attending all the wonderful theaters around us.
There's elements of what you're describing that I feel like arts and cultural organizations have worked over time to integrate into their traditional business model, sometimes successfully, but often not. And what you did was say, this is going to be the entirety of our programming, the entirety of our offer and operational kind of strategy. Why Out of Hand? The name Out of Hand?
Oh, so when I was 25 and too young to know better, my friends and I, who started Out of Hand Theater together, we thought, let's make something that's so wild, so sort of out of the box that it would never happen in any sort of regular theater. It's like it will get out of hand and it will be made out of the work of our hands. And then we've had that.
I love it. It reflects sort of a kinetic energy that it feels is part of the culture and reality of Out of Hand. So in between 2001 and 2020, what were there points of growth, points of change? Because 2020 was a point. It was a threshold. Were there points that you can look back on and say, here's how we evolved over that almost 20-year period?
A couple of big things happened along the way. One to do with what issues we address, and one to do with our business model. So the business model one is, very early on, people started hiring us in small ways to use our skills as theater artists to do something for them. And we realized, these are skills that you might be able to monetize. And then the other thing that happened is that in 2008, my husband and I built a home in the Martin Luther King Historic District here, right in the heart of downtown Atlanta. we just hadn't spent a lot of time in Black neighborhoods or Black schools, but we really wanted to invest in this neighborhood. And we decided to send our kids to the local elementary school, which is a school that's almost entirely Black. And it turns out is over 99% families living below the poverty line. And I'd never spent time in a school like that before. And I realized that despite feeling like I was a champion for social justice, I just hadn't spent time with people who looked and lived that differently before. And I realized that that's all it takes for people to care. If you just can facilitate a way for people to have positive, meaningful interactions with people who look and live differently from them, they will know more, they'll care more, and they'll do more to help change those injustices. And then I realized, theater is the perfect way to do that. You know, what better way to facilitate those kind of interactions and conversations? So that really steered our work. And now all of our work is based on dismantling the barriers identified by Dr. King to creating the beloved community, which are racism, poverty, and violence.
The decision to invest in a neighborhood and then get there and see. And you described for me, your children were in the public school system, and the sort of cognitive dissonance that came with your expectation about what schools would be provided and the resources that would be provided, and your realization that that is not at all equitably spread in our education system, as well as other kinds of observations, and your commitment to be part of that community that inspired even some of this work with Out of Hand, didn't it? I just want to spend another second or two there. It inspired you. You were already that person. Creativity can have an impact, but then it went to this impact.
Yeah, absolutely. For me, the most striking examples of just seeing what things were like at this school was that the teachers, the copiers didn't have any paper in them. So teachers need to make worksheets all of the time. And each teacher would have to have their own stash of paper that they had bought in their classroom. And when they needed a worksheet, they had to carry a little stack of their own paper to the copier, make right. that worksheet, and then carry the rest of the paper back to the classroom. And I just thought, and these incredible teachers with just such sunny dispositions and positive outlooks and so much energy doing this amazing work. This public school, Hope Hill Elementary, is literally on the grounds of the King Center. How could it be that, in 2009 or 2010, this could happen? And there are two predominantly white public schools within a 3-mile radius that lots of my friends' kids go to. Those two schools each have PTA budgets that are well over $100,000 that provide field trips and equipment and arts education. You pay for arts teachers at those schools. And this school had their PTA budget for the entire year was $400.
Yeah,
they couldn't buy anything. And so I thought, this is, how did I not know this before?
Yeah, right.
And now that I do know it, what can I do about it? So my first thought was, well, I can write some grants for them. I know how to write grants. So, I asked them if I could do that. They said yes. And then I thought, gosh, I wonder if there'd be any benefit to them to an after-school theater class for kids. I'm not going to teach it. I am not a good teacher, but I know great teachers who I can hire. And so I went to them and said, would this be of interest to you? And they said, yes, please. So I met with some local officials and principals and said, what would be useful? And what they said, particularly the elected officials, is these students need 21st century workforce skills that there isn't a class for in middle school or high school. They need better collaboration skills. They need confidence. Employers are looking for creativity. And they need better communication skills to get good jobs and then to succeed in the workplace. And I realized theater is a perfect vehicle for developing those skills. What do you need to make theater? Creativity, communication, collaboration, and confidence. And so we built Creative Kids, our kids program, first at that school to teach after school theater classes, but through a lens of those workplace skills. And we now serve 5 under-resourced public schools with year-long after-school programs. And in fact, at one of them, we actually supply a drama teacher during the day. And so the students actually get to take drama as part of their regular classes.
Seems to me that what you've developed is a business model around a just cause. So I think you've said it already, but just in this container, how would you describe the just cause of theater and creativity for out-of-hand theater?
Our goal is to use the tools of theater to help dismantle racism, poverty, and violence.
Right.
And the way that we see that theater can do that is by helping to advance understanding, empathy, and action around those issues. For us, that's why we've developed the program model that we have, the kind of recipe for our work, which is art plus information plus conversation equals social change. So the art is crucial. The art is what engages people's emotions and gives them a story to attach to and makes the message sticky. It's what opens hearts. But we don't want people to ever think that it's just a story or that it's just one person's experience. We want to give you a little bit of data too, give you the numbers that are not reaching people in the way that we'd like to, but to back up the story with the data. So here's what this social justice issue looks like in numbers or in data. But then we also want to invite people while they're in the room with the facts and their feelings to process that and make a plan for action. And that's what the conversation is for. So that we don't just spark conversations, we actually facilitate those conversations. We don't just start them, we finish them. And in that way, we make the most full use that we can out of the art that we produce.
You have these Zoom monthly equitable dinners, and then all of a sudden you have to grow your capacity to deliver on them. So how quickly did things change organizationally, budget-wise, during the 2020 and maybe 2021 kind of timeframe?
Theater critic Jesse Green had come to Atlanta in February of 2020, right before the shutdown, although of course none of us knew that at that time. And I had a lovely dinner with him, and he wrote an article. There was this window during which the Times was sending theater critics to other cities to cover theater in those cities. He wrote an article on Atlanta, and then he remembered us. So then when there was no live theater during the shutdown, he came back of his own accord and came to one of these monthly Equitable Dinners Online programs and wrote a beautiful review of it, and then put us on the best theater of 2020 list at the end of 2020, which really changed our lives. Said in 2020, as this was happening, Coca-Cola, who we had partnered with before, came back and said, we'd like you to make, it was like, you've got 3 weeks and we want 6 evenings of online programming in a row, but we'll pay you $100,000 to do it. And we were like, well, for us at this point, $100,000 is a lot of money. So we can't say no, and nobody's got work right now. You know, everybody's on hiatus, and you want to pay us $100,000 to, like, yeah, yes, we will stay up all night if that's what we have to do, and we'll figure it out. And then the Silicon Valley Community Foundation sent us an unsolicited gift for $50,000. And then it kept going like that. It was like we were in the right place at the right time, in that we had already focused our work on racial justice before the pandemic,
right,
and had a format of these short direct address monologues that worked better on Zoom than almost anything else. And so suddenly in 2020, it seemed like everybody turned towards us and said, we are going to either send you a check or we want to hire you.
This idea that creativity is an asset that can be utilized in a variety of use cases is so intriguing. And I am curious about how much of your current day revenues or staffing or creative energy is spent in community partnerships now that we're in 23, 24. Is it still a crucial part?
So it is 100% is. Mm-hmm. Out-of-Hand does not produce any programs at all that are not collaborations. So Every single one of our programs is a collaboration with one or more businesses, nonprofits, schools, or government agencies. Our shows and homes are our only ticketed program.
Yeah.
So ticket sales make up an incredibly small portion of our income, but even those are collaborations.
Okay, so now, today, your staff is how big? It's comprised of what kind of departments and types of activities fuel these kinds of experiences? Like you say, we don't just start the conversation, we facilitate it and finish it. There must be skill and expertise that are on your staff now. So just describe that for me.
Absolutely. So we went from in 2018, having a staff of one full-time, three part-time, to now having a staff of eight full-time, five part-time year-round contractors. So I'm the artistic director. We have a managing director. And Adria, as our director of equity and activism, she is in charge of crafting the Equitable Dinners programs and our Institute for Equity Activism,
yes,
and of hiring and training all of our facilitators.
Okay.
So many of our events, including Equitable Dinners, have a trained facilitator at every table who walks you through that conversation.
Yeah. Okay. And do you have the more, what I would call more traditional staff focus areas?
I oversee the work of our associate artistic director, Nikki Young, who works on a day-to-day basis with our playwrights, directors, and actors and designers. And she also leads Creative Kids and works with our teachers and the school. So she's got a lot on her plate. And then I oversee our communications manager, Christy, who is in charge of both fundraising and marketing. But she is assisted by a part-time grant writer and a part-time social media manager. And then our managing director oversees our operations manager and our programs associates, who are crucial in actually producing all of our programs, you know, on a weekly basis, because we have... So we don't just, you know, we don't run a venue, but we have programs happening in all of those buckets of programming all of the time. And so just the logistics of that and just the contracting and payroll of that is a big part of their
job. Completely. Small but mighty, small but high impact. How would you describe the consistent elements of the team of people who with you are driving these conversations? Who are you as a group of people? What are some words you'd put on?
Terribly ambitious, big dreamers. I regularly hear, you know, and sometimes I get taken aback. I regularly hear my partners and my colleagues say, we could do better. We should be serving twice as many people, or we should. And sometimes I want to go, wait a minute. Don't you know how much how many programs we do considering our size? It's enormous what we do. I mean, just our education program is, you know, we serve 250 students with 350 free classes at five schools. Some nonprofit arts organizations, that's half of what they do or all of what they do. And, you know, my partners will look at me and say, I think we should double that. I don't think we're doing as much as we could to serve Georgia's kids. So highly ambitious, big dreamers.
How do you recruit for highly ambitious big dreamers?
They seem to get referred to me, mm-hmm. which is so wonderful.
Mm-hmm.
So they come into the fold by meeting them at a random event or by some a friend of a friend who somebody thinks I should know. And I meet somebody and go, oh yeah, you're it. You are Out of Hand.
Well, there it is. You are out of hand. I go here because one of the major issues that the field has been reckoning with and reconciling is staffing. And I regularly hear from the field, and had some data, behind it when we were doing workshops. How satisfied are you with the output of your team? How do you feel about your senior team compared to the broader team? And if I were to aggregate everything that I know, I'd say that most leaders feel like they give their teams a B plus because there's been so much transition. There's so many new people, all the things that we've read and heard about. And yet 8 people and 5 contractors delivering across these 4 categories of programming. And now you're back up to 5 public schools. I hear that. It's quite something. It's quite something.
I think it goes back to what you said about the just cause, that people come to work excited at Out of Hand. And, of course we have bad days. We have conflict sometimes, it's not all sunshine and roses, but I think that people are driven because they are passionate about our just cause and they know that we mean it. And they're also, many of them, artists and are also really excited to get to use their skills as theater makers in service to this cause.
Of course. During the pandemic time, I said, please, everyone, let's think 2030. And the more research that I've done and conversations I've had, the more futurists I've read, the more I'm convinced that 2030's been here for, we're already in it. So much change has happened to us personally and in our communities that we've got to catapult beyond the now and really think about the transformations and disruptions that are going to take us, and by us, I mean creativity and ensuring that creativity is seen as essential and is woven into the fabric of our communities because we believe and know that it makes people better, makes communities better, helps enable. So as you think about 2040 for Out of Hand, what does that cause you to think about when I ask that question?
So our first goal in our last strategic plan was to be recognized as national leaders in arts and social justice collaborations. And I'm happy to say, I think we're there. Mm. But when I look ahead to 2040, I want us to be widely known, well-known national leaders in community collaborations in the arts. I think there's a lot we can do on a national scale that we have not yet been able to do with mostly focusing on Atlanta. I think that we have a role to play in helping other arts organizations develop revenue generating collaborations to address local issues in their communities that do not have to be social justice issues. Every community has issues it's grappling with, and theater, and I think even other performing and visual arts, can be part of the solutions.
I could not agree more, but I'm glad to hear you say maybe the model that we've developed in and for Atlanta could be something that would be of relevance to other performing arts organizations nationally. I can see that, and I'm curious about if you were in a room right now with a group of 100 chief execs of, let's just imagine, any type of performing arts organization. Let's just broaden it beyond theater for a minute. And what it took to be successful over these now many years in advancing these ideas and making them happen. What would you say to those group of 100? What are the requirements for an organization to be able to do this kind of work
to be willing to put your partner's goals first. And that may sound contradictory to the very important goals that you have and that you need to work for your own organization, but there's a reason why it will work out for you, I believe, and why it's the best advice to follow. If you truly use your skills as an artist or arts leader, use your craft, the craft that you know, to serve a partner organization's goals, first of all, they will see that. You will come across as authentic to them and to their constituents. And that can help you be a trusted leader in your community so that people will come because they're interested in the issue or they are interested in the partner organization and not just because they're interested in your art. And suddenly it multiplies the number of audience members who will engage with you. And you know, audiences are savvy and a lot of times they can tell if you programmed something and then you invite, you know, and you produced it and then you invited a partner organization who seemed to be kind of aligned to come in and give a talk back, that is a very different experience for them than if you went in and said, how can I use my tools to be of service to you? And I think there's something in that authenticity that attracts audiences and donors and clients. And what we found is that if you put your partner's goals first, then government agencies and businesses and nonprofits and schools will pay you for your art if you can truly make art that serves their goals. And that doesn't mean poor quality art. In fact, the quality is incredibly important because no partner organization's goals are going to be furthered by mediocre and certainly not by poor quality art. It has to be good in order to fulfill your partner's goals.
I'm curious if I know you've thought about it, your take on the regional theater realities today, and if you were within this room of metaphorical 100 CEOs, I wonder what you'd say, pay attention to, or remember that as we go to 24 and beyond. What if you could synthesize some realities and aspirational thoughts for this field?
Yeah, I know that there are a lot of theaters that are struggling right now. I think that the theater sector engaged in a really serious racial reckoning during the shutdown in a way that not all sectors did. And when we reopened, so many theaters were fired up or at least ready to try to take a meaningful stance and address racial equity and other equity issues through their programming and in their operations. And they weren't always able to bring their audiences along on that journey with them to be ready for that in the way that they were. Right. And so it is not surprising to me when I hear stories of audience members saying, listen, I'm just looking to escape all the terrible things that are happening in the world when I go to the theater. You know, I just want to be entertained. And I want theater to be able to give them that. But what I fear is that aside from the holiday shows that we love to do every winter, that there aren't enough people who will regularly choose theater as an entertainment option to sustain our field. So what I want to help do is to help other arts leaders find new reasons for new audiences to, you know, to brave the traffic and the weather and to pay for the tickets and the parking and the childcare to come to these live arts experiences that we love. And I think that one of the best ways to do that is to make art about local issues. Mm-hmm. They don't have to be social justice issues, whatever. Every community struggles with issues that the arts can help with and that can unlock new audiences and new earned income streams and new grants and new donations.
Art and creativity at work. You know, it's art and creativity at work. And we all want in this room, this metaphorical room of future and current listeners, we all want to tap creativity to make our communities better. And it will require new ways of thinking. That I am confident. It's why I'm so excited. I was so excited for this conversation, because your passion about it and your direct experience and belief resulting from that it can be different. Infusing, breathing that into the sector is something that you helped accomplish today for certain. Thank you for taking time with me. I couldn't be more pleased to have had this time with you.
Thank you so much, Jill. It was such a pleasure.
That's all for this episode of Leading the Way with Jill S. Robinson, brought to you by TRG Arts. Thanks for listening and believing that insightful, daring, and innovative leadership is the way to a more resilient future for the arts and cultural industry. Make sure to subscribe to Leading the Way on Apple Podcasts and Spotify. And if you found this episode helpful, please rate and review the show. For additional resources and to sign up for the podcast newsletter, we invite you to visit our website at leadingthewaypodcast.com.